I'm James Hahn II.
And I'm Mark LaCour.
And you're listening to This Week in Oil and Gas. This is the podcast for busy oil pros who want to quickly keep their finger on the pulse of the industry. Welcome in, Mr. LaCour.
Thanks, James. Glad to be back.
Yeah, man. Episode number 007. So we are doing some international espionage. Out of the gate, if you've never joined us before, we're going to plow through about 8 or 9 of the top oil and gas stories from around the globe in less than 20 minutes. Let's jump in. PetroChina catches Exxon as world's most valuable oil company. What's going on, Mr. LaCour?
Yeah, so this was unexpected. PetroChina, which is mostly owned by the government of China, actually passed ExxonMobil as far as capitalization. Before the crash of oil, Exxon was at about $450 billion a year company. Now they've dropped that down to about $352 billion. PetroChina is now up to $353, so they actually surpassed Exxon, which, like I said, was unexpected.
So what is this? Is this an historic event by which by whom the bell tolls, or whatever they say?
Yeah, I don't think most people in the stock world would call this historic. I think a lot of those guys suspected this would happen. Just from an oil and gas point of view, it is actually somewhat surprising, because not that long ago, PetroChina was a dot on the map. Now, of course, in the competitive world of oil and gas, PetroChina has some cards stacked for it that Exxon doesn't have. But PetroChina has been out there aggressively pursuing leases around the world, brokering deals with other national oil companies, as well as Exxon. You know, this switch in positions, I believe, is temporary. You know, Exxon, and people have heard me say this before, Exxon's the best damn oil and gas engineering company on the planet, bar none. Nobody can get oil out of the ground as economically and as safe as Exxon, but they're a bit of a big old ship. So when you have things change in the market like these oil prices, it takes Exxon longer than most to adopt to that. But they're just fine. I fully expect Exxon to take number one in the next 24 months.
What were some of those stacked factors? Is that just because they don't work in a free market?
Yeah, I mean, Exxon has to go out and compete for oil and gas leases. I'll give you a good example. If Exxon wanted to go drill in Brazil, they can't. That by law, they have to find a joint venture with Petrobras. And that's going on all over the world. So there's places in China or in the Asia area that Exxon simply cannot drill. Exxon is running out of places to drill, and you're having the nationalized oil companies have unfair advantages and tilting the odds in their favor. But that's just the way it is. And unfortunately for the U.S., and most of the population doesn't know this, we don't play that, right? So if you're a foreign company and you want to come drill in the Gulf of Mexico, if you meet our safety and financial insurance regs, you're allowed to. For instance, in the Gulf of Mexico, Statoil, which is a Norwegian oil company, has more leases than anybody. The U.S. just doesn't stack the deck in favor of its oil and gas companies, unlike the rest of the world.
Well, damn them. So what about the rest of the world over in England in West Sussex? We've got over 300 billion pounds worth of oil, quote, discovered. I'm not sure why they're putting it in quotes.
Yeah, it's because this article is written with a bit of an environmental slant, so of course you can have the quotes around it. This is really good detective work. This is using cutting-edge technology to discover oil in an area of the UK that they thought there was little to no recoverable oil. And there's a significant find here. Now, of course, environmentalists are jumping up and down saying, well, look, even if we find it, we don't want to get out the planet because we already have enough oil and gas to melt the planet down, which is simply not true. The thing you never hear anybody say is that the UK and the US, our air pollution peaked in the 1980s and has declined every year since then. We know how to use oil and gas environmentally responsibly, and we're getting better and better at it. So this is actually a great thing. Now, it's going to be interesting to see with these low crude prices if they decide to develop the field. My gut would tell me they won't. This field's a little bit expensive, and right now oil's hovering around $58 a barrel. I suspect they'll get everything in motion and wait till oil hits about 64 or 65 and then go ahead and pull the trigger on it.
So I see here it says 8.6 billion barrels of potential recoverable. What does that look like compared to, I don't know, say the Eagle Ford?
So this is actually less, but that 8.6 billion barrels is about a fifth of what's been pumped out of the North Sea in the last 40 years. So it's not a small discovery. It's a
no.
large discovery.
Yeah, well, damn them for putting those quotes around them. Well, we will keep our eye on that one, because with our Falkland story last week and then this one, lots happening in the world of oil and gas over there in England. And now to the big story. Shell challenges Exxon dominance with $70 billion bid for BG. I heard that you had a conversation with some journalists about this earlier.
Yeah, I got pinged by the BBC in London, and they actually did an interview about this on this exact story. And this is a great story. Now, we've been forecasting this since last year. This is going to be the year for mergers and acquisitions. This is a really good move by Shell. So Shell, in the last, say, 8 or 10 years, has turned its portfolio predominantly to gas. So most of their recoverable reserves are gas reserves, but they've had some barriers to market. They have some barriers to gas market in Asia Pacific and also in Australia. And so by buying BG, they immediately have access to that market. And BG is also a gas company. BG, of course, stands for British Gas. So this is a really good deal because we predict that natural gas is becoming more and more of a world fuel source. It's instantly 50% cleaner than burning coal. We've now developed the technologies, liquefied natural gas, compressed natural gas, gas to liquids, to be able to move that natural gas around the world. There's a big price discrepancy, which means there's a lot of profit to be made. So this is a very smooth move by Shell. Now, let me tell you, from inside the oil and gas patch, the rumor's been going on forever that Shell was going to buy BG. And actually, like it came true. And even BG shareholders got treated to a premium. So this is really a win-win all around. Now, I have to throw this piece in here. Once again, I think this is another driver that's going to push Exxon to pick up British Petroleum, you know, so they can compete at this level. This merger, when it's done, is going to grow Shell to almost the size of Exxon. So Exxon's not going to appreciate somebody else having more as much scope as they do.
Did they overpay for it at all?
No, I don't think they overpaid for it at all. BG, unfortunately, had made some bad decisions. They invested heavily in American shale, but quite frankly, they did not have the expertise to get it out like the American operators can. So they ended up having to sell it at a loss. So they bought it at a premium and sold it at a loss, which devalued their stock. So, I think Shell actually paid a little bit more than they should have, but I think they did that from a cultural point of view, right? BG's could roll right into the Dutch Shell culture very easily. And I think Shell wanted to make sure that all the stockholders and all the employees were very happy with the deal.
Yeah. So, and then later in the article here, it says, but don't expect a wave of late 90s style consolidation, which rolls into our next article from the Wall Street Journal. Shell's move could prompt wave of energy sector mergers. No news if you've been listening to the past several episodes of this podcast, but what are we talking about here with the Wall Street Journal?
Yeah, this is another one of those cases where I suspect that Wall Street Journal has been paying attention to us and they scoop our copy. We've been talking about this since last year. It's just the climate is right? You have a lot of good financial players in the oil and gas industry that can weather this storm. And you have some people in this industry right now that are actually profiting from this low crude prices. And then you had a lot of the people, and most of them were not oil and gas people, that when the shale boom happened, saw the money to be made, invested a lot of money, but built bad financial models. So now with those low crude prices, you now have the typical merger and acquisition environment where you have some strong people with strong balance sheets and you have some people that are upside down. So you just naturally have mergers and acquisitions going to happen.
So so XTO was the last major acquisition that Exxon did?
Yeah, that typical Exxon fashion. They saw what was going on in Shell in North America. Their peers, Shell and Chevron and BP, wanted to build it themselves, their own Shell production facilities. And Exxon goes, we don't know anything about Shell. Let's find the company that's best at it and buy them. And that's what they did. They bought XTO, which was, they're just an awesome operator in the North American Shell plays. And so that's why Exxon's still very sound in Shell, because they bought a company that knew how to get that oil and gas out of the ground economically. Whereas, unfortunately, Chevron's Mid-Continent, which is their Shell unit they built themselves, and Chevron's Shell play North America, they've just struggled. And we just talked about how BG did the same thing. So, usual Exxon thing, if I can't build it, I'll buy it.
Right. But didn't Shell pull out of the Eagle Ford, or at least one of the major Texas
players?
Oh, no.
Yeah, they all did. They all sold assets that they bought at a premium and then sold it for pennies on the dollar just to get out from under that debt. And like I said, most of the profitable operators in the Shell plays, the Oxys and the Newports, they're just fine at $50, $55 a barrel. But that's because they know what they're doing.
So it looks like late in the article here, they're talking about Repsol doing a bid for Talisman.
Yeah, and you can see a lot of that. We suspect somebody's going to make a pitch even at Anadarko. And we actually suspect that maybe Exxon.
Anadarko.
Yep. Exxon's sitting on enough cash to pick up BP and Anadarko. Now, we're not going to predict they're picking up Anadarko. It's just on our radar. But we will predict that they will pick up BP.
Yeah. Okay. Well, switching gears here now to pipelines and also welcoming Seeking Alpha back into the fray. Our bad for not getting Seeking Alpha in last week. So we've got comparing North America's new three largest oil and gas pipeline companies. What is happening?
Yeah, so it's the midstream part in North America is making money. Not hand over fist, but pretty close to hand over fist. And you got three major players. All of them are good pipeline operators. All of them have grown from small companies to large companies. All of them have done that by acquisition. So you have Kinder Morgan, which is headquartered right here in Houston. You got Enbridge, which is in Alberta, Canada. And then you have Williams Companies in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And between the three of them, they own the majority of the pipelines in North America. Now, they have different geographies and they have different business models, but they're all really good companies. And let me just throw a plug out there for Kinder Morgan. I actually know Rich Kinder. Rich Kinder, who runs Kinder Morgan, can do more with a dollar than anybody I've ever seen in my entire life. So I'm a big fan of Kinder Morgan, and they actually contribute a lot of time and manpower to help on the political side in oil and gas. So, you know, hats off to that company for stepping into the battle ring with environmentalists when necessary.
When you say more with a dollar, I mean, what is he? Is he coupon clipping or what? How do you mean?
He knows how to drive operational efficiencies, which isn't something that you see on a continental scale with the pipeline companies. Most pipeline companies historically have thought regionally. You know, Kinder thinks continent wise. So if Kinder can get a better price of steel from some steel place in Chicago, and he needs to help them stand up their facilities, Kinder will invest money in that steel producer's facilities to grow it so he can get the best steel price, which in turn helps the steel producer in Chicago, which in turn helps everybody. It's just a way of thinking about the business that you don't usually see in pipeline companies.
Got it. Okay. And then we've got the Canadians up there in Calgary and Williams Company in Tulsa.
Yeah. And like I said, they've all grown with this abundance of natural gas and cheap, sweet crude that's being produced in the U.S. by fracking. What you don't realize, you have to move it somewhere to make money off of. Typically, you're moving it to a refinery or an ethylene cracker. The best, cheap, and most environmentally responsible way to move that is in a pipeline. Well, since the frack fields are new, and since all these ethylene crackers are new, there's no infrastructure. There is no pipeline to connect it to. It's sort of like if you built a new house, you have to plug into the electrical, into the sewer, into the water. How do you do that? Well, you do that with pipes. And that's what these companies are capitalizing on. And this isn't a short-term thing. This could be at least 50 years of construction for these companies and others to get this infrastructure built in the U.S.
Yeah, and at the end of the article, they're proclaiming Enbridge with an energetic lead, outperforming in 16 metrics and underperforming in 7. At any rate, they say that Enbridge is the one of the three. Do you agree?
Unfortunately for Kinder, even though I know Rich, I'm gonna have to say yes. I think Enbridge is doing a better job. Enbridge is thinking outside the box. A couple of years ago, a lot of super tankers or mid-sized tankers were devalued. Basically, they were worth pennies on the dollar. Well, Enbridge said, you know what? I'm going to pick up a couple of tankers. So they've picked up a couple of offshore oil ships. And now they know that if they can get more price of their crude on the East Coast, they can offload it from their pipelines in the Gulf of Mexico, go around Florida and sell it on the East Coast. If they get more for the West Coast, they offload it in the Gulf of Mexico to their tankers, you know, shoot it through the Panama Canal and go sell on the West Coast. I mean, pipeline companies don't normally think that way. I think it's a very strategic move on their part.
All right, so we moved midstream, and now I guess we're more upstream with service companies. Why should I care? Another one from Seeking Alpha. Why should I care about oil and gas field service companies, Mark?
Because oil and gas service companies are going to be the place to watch from an investment point of view. So just 2 years ago, the frack fields were going crazy, and the service companies were actually experiencing inflation. So literally, Halliburton did not have enough people or pumps or parts to service everybody, so naturally, the prices went up. Well, now with these low crude prices, the service companies are trying to maintain cash flow and, quite honestly, keep their people working. So they're willing to cut their profit margins to maintain that business. Well, what's going to happen is, even though with these low crude prices, our shelf fields, our good operators, have been very resistant to the global price pressures. They're actually still making money at these low prices, which means they still need the service companies. Now, the growth is not going to be crazy like it was the last couple of years where they were had, you know, double-digit growth, 20, 30, 35%. But the growth is still going to be there, 3 to 4% a year. So a wise investor actually can look at this, pick and choose the right companies, and understand what their business model is, invest, and make some money on this.
So they're basically just saying this is not necessarily a blue chip, but somewhat of a reliable thing to look at for the next, it says here, 5 years.
Oh, yeah. So let me tell you, right now, fortunes are being made or fortunes are being lost. But that won't realize until the price of crude comes back up. And then we'll see who the good guys were, who the guys that didn't really think it through.
All right. So it, I loved that that takeaway right there. On that point, when the crude prices come up, well, we've got to talk about production, because Alan Gilmer came out on the 7th with Drilling Info's U.S. oil production forecast. What did Mr. Gilmer have for us today?
Man, this is some awesome work by Alan and his team over there at Drilling Info. They literally took a lot of complex information, which quite honestly, some of it I don't even understand. And they broke it down to some very simple, very factual graphs and pieces of data so you can understand what's actually going. You actually understand that even though drilling rig count's going down, production's going up, and they've done a good job of shortening that out historically, but also looking at when do they think it's going to peak. That peak is real important, but that peak is moving because of changes in technologies. You know, wells that would peak after 4 years just a couple of years ago, now they're able to peak at 5 or 6 years, which increased the production curve. So this is just fantastic information. Anybody that's has an interest in oil and gas production in North America and wants to get a feel for what's going on right now and what's going to go on in the future, they should look at this.
So U.S. oil production will reach a maximum daily rate of 9.81 million barrels of oil per day in May and drop to around 9.5 million barrels of oil per day around where we were in March before trending up a bit by the end of the year. So I guess that would be trending up based on probably
demand. It's good to be driven up by demand.
Okay,
so
got it.
What's going to happen? The world is using more in oil and gas every year than it used to. Now the countries that are using it change around. We actually have declining use in the U.S. and in Europe, and that's to be expected, right? Our cars are more energy efficient. We now have tablets instead of cathode ray computers. We build more energy efficient houses. But other countries are still in their industrial growth modes. Countries like India, right, and a lot of Asia Pacific, a lot of Africa. So the world will continue to use it. Now, not to get into politics here, but damn it, we need to revoke the export ban on crude, right? Our operators need to be able to sell this crude to the highest bidder instead of it being forced here in the U.S. And we actually think the government's going to do that. So let's hope they do.
Testify. All right. So bringing it home, potential U.S. natural gas resources hit record 2515 TCF. That's a large number.
Yeah, that's trillion cubic feet. The short version is we're not going to run out of gas in this country until the sun runs out of helium to convert to hydrogen. I mean, it's crazy. Now, this is based upon just our current reservoirs. What they don't talk about is that we discover new reservoirs every year, and we discover new technologies to get even more gas out. And this is just a wonderful story. You know, natural gas is a great fuel. It's extremely environmentally responsible. It's a great bridge fuel as we move toward more renewables. And I'm not going to go down the renewable route because some of the renewables, quite honestly, are a waste of money and they're being propped up by taxpayers. But some things like wind, that's a great source of energy if you do it right. Here in Texas, we're the number one wind producer in the country.
Yeah, people don't know that.
Yeah, but we're only because it's done for profit. It's not subsidized by the state government. And so companies come in and invest money because they can make money. But natural gas is just a great fuel. You can run school buses on it. You can run electrical generation plants. You can convert it into plastics. And we just got a ton of it, basically, is what this article is saying.
Yeah, yeah. And the reason I grabbed this one is because there were several different separate articles that were talking about how reserve estimates went up in the Appalachian Basin and all these different places. So it was nice to find one that actually just sort of compiled all that into one thing to say exactly what you're saying, which is, yeah, we have a lot of fuel.
we have so much fuel that if we discover no more, which is not going to happen, but if we stop looking for natural gas and we start exporting this, right? So not only the gas that we use, but the stuff we export, we have 300 years of natural gas. I mean, it's crazy.
That's insane. Okay, all right. Well, those were the top stories. We have some leftovers that we're going to throw into the show notes. Particularly one that's was from FuelFix.com that was from Jennifer Hillard. Shout out. And it was about something that happened in San Antonio this week. It said, laid off in the oil field. This industry wants to hire you. So obviously, we know there's still a heck of a lot of jobs out there. And this was just one event highlighting that. And so we're going to throw that in the show notes, as well as the links to all of the different organizations that were part of that event for any of y'all who are out there looking. And then also, we have our weekly Onion. I guess I won't read the full thing, right, Mark?
Are we marked as an explicit show on iTunes?
No, we are not an explicit show. So F everything, Gillette says. F everything, we're doing Five Blades. This is from February 18th, 2004. So yeah, I'm 10 years older and it's still funny to me. So either I need to grow up or it's that funny.
You and I both may need to grow up, but I don't think it's that funny.
Well, that's probably because you haven't read the whole thing yet. Okay, so it's beyond ridiculous, and we're beyond our time. Quick finish events. We have the Houston Energy Breakfast coming up next, the 17th, and then OTC, right?
Yep, and then next week we have API Houston Meat Luncheon, and then we have the Nomads Dinner. Next show, we're going to do a deep dive in OTC. If you don't know what OTC is, look it up. It's the world's largest oil and gas trade show. It takes place here in Houston, Texas. It's also the fourth largest trade show of any kind. If you're in oil and gas, or if you're even thinking about oil and gas, you better be there.
All right, perfect. So we're going to get all those links up in the show notes. You have anything else to add, Mr. LaCour?
Nope. Do great work. Pay it forward. We will see you next time.
Go find some grease, guys. Try and start.